We've been talking about this for at least a year and a half. We have been so excited. We just teased it last episode. Now we bring you another bonus Sunstone Mormon History Podcast episode, something that we are really excited for because it's kind of groundbreaking research, and it's not often that we have groundbreaking research on the podcast that hasn't been published in the 1920s, which is where I got Sam Brannan's information. So bring you up to date with the best stuff. I am so happy to introduce Katie Ludlow Rich, who, if you follow The Exponent too, she's been a writer. How long have you been writing there?
A year and a half
is the lucky number. So you write for The Exponent, you presented at MHA the last 2 years, but the most important thing is that you are an award-winning Sunstone Mormon history podcast trivia player at Sunstone.
We mentioned this when we teased it last time, but you know, MHA happens every year, and sometimes you'll hear about things. There has been no more presentation that's gotten more buzz than your first one last year. I mentioned this last time. I was back at the store and I wasn't there, so I was just kind of seeing what everyone was saying about it. And all of a sudden, people went nuts about it. Artists, partial, gushed about it. I was like, if you can get artists to gush about something, you're doing something right. So
you two are making me blush. Stop.
I'm serious. I was there the day at MHA, like when you gave this. It is such an important part of Mormon history. You're excavating stories that people don't talk about. As someone who did Year of Polygamy trying to highlight women's stories, I was so excited when I heard about this. And so I think the minute after you got out and you were like hounded by the throngs of fans, I was like, hey, will you come on the podcast? And you were like, give me a minute, please. So that minute has passed and now you are here sharing your research for us. So let's talk about, our listeners actually don't know what we're talking about yet. We've been teasing that something good is coming from Katie Ludlow Rich, but because it's new and emerging, you haven't really announced it other than at MHA. So let's talk about the basis for your research. What have you been investigating?
My working title for this is The Shadow Succession Crisis, Challenging the Claim that Brigham Young Disbanded the Relief Society in 1845.
And I've actually made that claim on the Year of Polygamy podcast, as have so countless people.
Everyone.
As everyone, because that's where the research has led us so far.
All right. So we've got a couple key statements from Brigham Young that create this confusion. What did he say?
Yeah. So there's this day, March 9th, 1845. This is the key day, 9 months after the murder of Joseph Smith, that Brigham Young preached to an assembly of high priests and then later that day to a meeting of the 70s quorum. And in both meetings, minutes record Brigham declaring his opposition to the Female Relief Society resuming meetings. And so to the high priest, he said, I say I will curse every man that lets his wife or daughters meet again until I tell them what a relief society's for, to relieve us of our best men. They relieved us of Joseph and Hiram. And then to the 70s, he said, when I want sisters or the wives of the members of this church to get up relief society, I will summon them to my aid. But until that time, let them stay home. And if you see females huddling together, veto the concern. And so with such deliciously incendiary language, it's no wonder that these statements have become a popular source for the now nearly ubiquitous claim inside Mormon studies that Brigham Young disbanded the Relief Society in Nauvoo.
Yeah, so I remember hearing this. It was wild to me as it was kind of a crisis of faith to think that, like, wait, Brigham Young hated women so much he got rid of Relief Society. And I like the huddling together quote. I think Laura Ulrich uses that later on in her female thing, you know, the idea of women huddling together. But the thing that I love most about this is we've been talking about the succession crisis now all summer and fall, and it's all the dudes. It's this contender and this contender and this priesthood guy and this priesthood guy. And they're like, where are the women in Nauvoo at this time?
The women in Nauvoo are working to prepare for the temple, and then they are working in the temple right alongside the Quorum of the Twelve, and they are left out a lot of those histories, even though that they are there step by step, side by side, doing the anointed quorum and then doing the temple work as they prepare to go west.
So that's what is so exciting about your research today, because not only are you going to tell us, you know, about where this other half of the Mormon population are coming from, but also this idea of the Relief Society, how women's power works, this misinterpretation about what happens in the history. And you're going to walk us through this. This is an excellent bonus episode. I want you to tell us about some of the interesting modern history that suggests that we're taking the Brigham Young quote out of context. So did he disband the Relief Society? How would you answer that?
Well, thank you, Lindsay. I would answer that with no. So this claim emerged for the first time in the 1980s. 1970s and 1980s was a really exciting time in Mormon history. We call this like the new Mormon history. There's this professionalized history that's happening in the church for the first time. And scholars are initially grappling with the complicated, nuanced end of Relief Society meetings in Nauvoo. And over the following decade, the claim kind of simplified that Brigham Young disbanded the Relief Society in 1845. But for more than a century before that, sources ranging from the writings of Eliza R. Snow and Emmeline Wells to official histories published by the General Board of the Relief Society, they identified the conditions in Nauvoo surrounding the martyrdom as the reason that formal meetings ceased, while arguing that the women carried on the spirit of the work. And it wasn't until 1983 that we start seeing Brigham's words from those March 9th, 1845 meetings being introduced to the modern record as a factor for the end of Relief Society meetings. So there's articles in 1983 by Maureen Ersenbach Beecher and Richard L. Jensen, and they just kind of treat these statements as a factor in the end. And Linda King Newell included Brigham's statements in two articles in the 1980s, one of which was anthologized in Maxine Hank's Women in Authority in 1992. And again, it's one factor among several. And there's other books and articles that continue to use this claim. And then in Mormon Enigma by Linda King Newell and Valene Tippetts Avery, this incredible book about the biography of Emma Smith. So it's originally published in 1984 and then lightly revised in 1994. And the nuance around Young's statements kind of fade away into what closely matches the dominant narrative seen in Mormon studies today. So they argue that the official history of the Relief Society erroneously states that the operations were suspended in 1844 due to the various calamities which befell the saints. And then they identify Young's March 9th, 1845 words to the 70s as the reason the women did not meet again. So the narrative put forth in Mormon Enigma just gained traction over the years. And since the mid-1990s, the claim that Brigham Young disbanded the Relief Society in 1845 has been repeated by all kinds of scholars. So LDS and non-LDS and books and articles and publications by the LDS Church. And the 2016 landmark publication, The First 50 Years of Relief Society, a documentary history, it's this incredible work. And it's also notable in expanding the claim because this claim was prominent in the editorial essays in the book, as well as in the tour kind of, or like the
it was a big deal when that book came out.
Yeah.
It came to Benchmark. We did a signing with them there. It was everywhere for a while.
Yeah, in the promotion of the book. Yeah. So it's repeated in blogs and news articles and conference presentations and podcasts that Brigham Young disbanded the Relief Society in 1845.
There's a lot of stuff I like about your research, but this I found so interesting because I love finding where ideas start. I just think that's fascinating. And you can kind of see how it happens, right? As researchers, you love finding shiny new things. So coming across these statements from Brigham Young that, as far as we can tell, scholars have not seen since he said them.
And they're harsh statements too, right? Like he's saying, basically, my interpretation of that is like, it's what got Joseph Smith killed, the women. Like, how do you take statements like that? Or are we going to talk about that?
We will talk about that, Lindsay.
All right, let's get into it. Because as someone who has perpetuated the history on a podcast, this is how the craft works. Like, I'm sure it was shocking when you put this out there for people to feel like their work was challenged. But that's the beauty of history. It's kind of scientific. And you put something out there, it's challenged, it's debated, and you have to correct the record. And so I'm so excited that we get to do that here, and that you are doing this is a gift to us to help us understand it. So anyone that feels defensive about it, take a breath. This is
maybe
new information.
Think about, why do you feel defensive about it?
Well, you know, as someone who's, you know, that's a sexy narrative, right? As someone who the whole year of Polygamy Podcast is about excavating women's histories. And now we have a villain, Brigham Young, who has shut down the Relief Society, and far be it from me from exonerating that man. Like that's a sexy, compelling story that's why we don't talk about women, because he shut it down. So I can see why people get attached to that, especially if you publish that.
And you do a good, you made a very good point there that it goes from becoming a nuanced multi-factor thing to becoming the factor. And that's important. And again, you can see how that happens with historians. But and that's the caution, is you constantly have to step back from your research and think, okay, why am I getting so attached to this? I need to reevaluate. So let's go through. Let's talk about why these past interpretations can be problematic, and then what effects they have on our history larger writ.
Yeah. And so one question I get is this a matter of semantics, right? But it's not. It's not just a question of whether it was disbandment or suspension or some other synonym about Brigham Young, like ending the Relief Society. It's not about those words. You know, it's this broader context. So I kind of challenge it in multiple ways. So first, the context of the actual final meetings of the Relief Society offer a reasonable explanation for why it ceased to function as an ecclesiastical organization in Nauvoo. So the meetings stopped a full year before Brigham's statements in 1845. The last ones were in March of 1844. And then second, there's a lack of contemporary evidence that any women heard Young's words from the March 1845 meetings or changed their actions according to his words. But Young had, you know, ample opportunity to publicize his words and address the women directly. And then third, I have this idea of the shadow succession crisis, where women of the Relief Society broke with their president, Emma Smith, accepted Young as the leader of the church, and engaged in new priestly functions and acted in ways that shaped Young's succession and the future of the Relief Society. And it allows scholars to excavate women from the records of that time and bring women further into the discussion of institutional power.
And that's the one I'm the most excited in talking about, because I love this idea of the shadow succession crisis. Because again, like I said, we're guilty of it on this podcast. All the research we have is what the men are doing, and that becomes the dominant narrative of priesthood power. And you know, as I do, growing up in the LDS church, priesthood didn't matter to me as much as it does to the men. That's not the Mormonism for me. I mean, I know that some women care about priesthood lineage and stuff like that, but that was never an interest to me. So this idea that there was a succession crisis happening within the ranks of the women is fascinating.
Couple thoughts on that. First, the phrase is genius, because it's such a good phrase, and it's the kind of thing that has sticking power. It's the kind of idea that will marinate in people's minds. Another thing, we talked about this before we started recording, is it was so shocking to me. It shouldn't have been, but it was. In looking at earlier histories and biographies of this period, to realize how little the Relief Society is talked about, and that's if it's talked about. And I think that's something that contemporary readers probably very soon we'll start to forget, as there were times when first 50 years of Relief Society and at the pulpit didn't exist. And so talking about and having those records right at your fingertips wasn't a thing. And that's important to remember, that part of our, you know, the history of our history.
Right. And this kind of claim, when it has such a sticking power, that Brigham Young disbanded the Relief Society, it has this massive impact on the record, where once we accept that claim, then we stop talking about what women did, because Brigham disbanded them. And so the things that they did become this idea that it's just informal. They're just acting to comfort one another. This is all just relational and not about institutional power and relationships with powerful men. It's just women doing girly things.
And I think for me, like when I heard it, it contributed to the sense of inferiority that I already felt as a woman. You know, it's like when you learn that women didn't pray or didn't speak, you know, before the 1980s or whatever, it's at church or in general conference, you're like, what? And then you hear this stuff and you're like, we've never been valued. And while, you know, there are certainly elements of that, and I don't want to discount that. I mean, Year of Polygamy is full of that. There's a lot of good, you know, research about this. I imagine you're probably getting some pushback on this narrative, because it is a narrative to sort of indict Brigham Young, which a lot of people want to do, right?
Brigham had no game, right?
I've heard that somewhere. I
don't know where I've heard that, but
it was on like a shirt or something.
Yeah.
Another thing that I really like about your research is that it provides concrete, easy ways to improve how history is written. And I loved your example of how the informal, the use of that term informal. When women are doing these things, it's termed informal. If men are doing the exact damn same things, it's an extension of their calling or something. It's always official. But if women are doing it, it's by de facto informal. That's so important. And it's so commonly described that way that it almost feels natural to write about it that way.
Right. We have these famous stories about like Brigham leaving the temple right before the wagons are going to roll west, and people begging to do more work, and Brigham returns and, you know, works night and day to get hundreds more people through. But we don't talk about how women are also right there working in the temple night and day, performing ordinances and acting as clerks. And we just kind of,
but
just
that's
Brigham.
Informal labor, Katie.
Very informal.
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan,
bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
Okay, so obviously there's an end to general release study meetings in Nauvoo. You say that, you acknowledge that, March...
We're not arguing about that.
March 1844.
That's not the
deal. Pay attention to the date, though. March 1844. Joseph Smith is still alive in March 1844. So let's just keep that in mind. So what were some of the events that led to that?
Almost immediately upon their founding in March of 1842, the Relief Society became embroiled in concerns about both the rumor and the practice of plural marriage, which I think Lindsay might know a little bit about. So the impetus, so we know, you know, the famous story of the founding of Relief Society of Sarah Kimball and Margaret Cook wanting to create a sewing society to assist the temple laborers, and Joseph tells them, you know, I have something better for you, that I have desire to organize the sisters in the order of the priesthood, and now I have the key by which I can do it. And so the Relief Society is organized, and Emma Smith becomes the president of the Relief Society. And it starts with these 28 members and quickly blooms to over 1,300 women. And they have these intentions to assist the laborers building the temple, but also to care for the poor. And then Joseph charges them with correcting the morals and strengthening the virtues of the female community. And this final charge pretends conflict, as Joseph was already secretly married to some of the society's earliest members and would go on to marry more in the months to follow. So we won't be able to go into a full exploration of how plural marriage affected Relief Society.
Oh, is that complicated, Katie?
It might be a little bit. I mean, I've heard there's a podcast you can listen to that talks about it a little bit more. But essentially, if Relief Society was founded in the eye of the hurricane of Nauvoo plural marriage by the middle of 1844, the winds had shifted and the center did not hold. So that brings us to these final meetings, right? So the final four meetings were in March of 1844, and Emma is calling the women to correct the morals and denounce the spiritual wife system. And that was the central focus of these meetings. So a few months, or the month prior, in February, Joseph's mayoral court tried, convicted, and fined a blacksmith named Erasmus F. Bostwick on charges of slander for his accusations that Hiram Smith participated in an adulterous spiritual wife system and that a number of women in Nauvoo were engaged in promiscuity and prostitution. So in response to Bostwick's accusations, Joseph's clerk, William W. Phelps, wrote a document called The Voice of Innocence from Nauvoo in defense of the morals and virtues of the women of Nauvoo. And so it's first read in a meeting on March 7th, led by Joseph in front of a large gathering on the temple grounds. And then Emma slightly modifies the text and uses it as a basis of her Relief Society meeting. So there's two meetings on March 9th and two on March 16th. And they do it because they've divided the Relief Society into these four geographical wards, not ecclesiastical wards, but geographical wards. And she wants everyone to have a chance to come to the meetings. So they hold four of them, and they're roughly the same. And so the text of The Voice of Innocence, so it has colorful ways of calling upon the death and rot of men who would stain the virtue of Nauvoo women. And it and it concludes with the resolve to raise our voice and hands against John C. Bennett's spiritual wife system as a scheme of profligates to seduce women. Let polygamy, bigamy, fornication, adultery, and prostitution be frowned out of the hearts of honest men to drop off in the gulf of fallen nature. So Emma calls upon the women, and the document was unanimously adopted in each meeting and then was published in the newspaper, The Nauvoo Neighbor, with the explicit approval of the Relief Society. But in addition to adopting The Voice of Innocence, Emma read another document and instructed the women in terms that would have made her disapproval for plural marriage clear. So we know that there is kind of this coded language, this distinction between celestial marriage and spiritual wifery or polygamy, and that they could have these coded languages to talk about things without really talking about them. But then this
John C. Bennett's system.
Yes. Remember? Yes. But this other document, I think, makes it clear that she's talking about all of this stuff, the real stuff, the celestial marriage too. So she reads this epistle of President J. Smith's, and it refers to this document that was first presented to the Relief Society on March 31st, 1842. So that first month of their founding, Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, Hiram Smith, and three other men signed this epistle, and Joseph read it to the women, and it... the women are instructed in this epistle to shun any man who claims to have authorization for any practice contrary to the old established virtues, whether they are prophets, seers, or revelators, patriarchs, 12 apostles, elders, priests, mayors, generals, city councilors, aldermen, marshals, police, lord, mayors, or the devil. In rereading the epistle, Emma was reminding the women that these men taught that they neither acted contrary to old established virtues nor had any authority by which to change these habits and customs. And then she told the women to follow the teachings of President Smith from the stand. She was aware that he taught different things in private than he did from the stand. And he's telling the women that, like, none of these men have authority to change the marriage system. Do what he says from the stand, not what he does in private. And she says at the end, we're like, we'll meet again when we find a suitable place to meet. But there are no further meetings after that time. And we can kind of assume that this inflamed some feelings among the women, as dozens of Relief Society women were married to Joseph or other leading men at this time. But we don't have a ton of documentary evidence, but we do have evidence of Joseph getting kind of sore over the matter. So he has some conflicts with William Law, who was initially this close friend and served as a counselor in the first presidency. He and his wife participated in the anointed quorum, where they received what became known as temple ordinances. And then on May 23rd, 1844, Joseph was indicted on charges of adultery in the Hancock County Circuit Court based on the sworn statements of William Law and his brother Wilson. So this followed the prospectus of the famous Nauvoo Expositor, which was going to be published by the Laws and their associates, which promised to expose the religious and legal corruption of Nauvoo, including polygamy. So Joseph becomes distraught by this growing legal and social trouble surrounding him, and he says that he never had any fuss with these men until that female Relief Society brought out the paper against adulterers and adulteresses. But Joseph himself had been the one to preside at the meeting where the Voice of Innocence was first read. He had removed William Law from the first presidency in January of that year without following the stated procedures, which inflamed the conflict with Law. So he knew of conflict specifically with William Law already, and he knew of this document before the women read it. So I'm thinking that this is more about his relationship with Emma and their conflict about plural marriage than about the Relief Society itself.
And this whole public-private thing, obviously, we're reaping the benefits of that now with polygamy denial. Because if you focus on those public things very carefully, you can make that case that Joseph Smith was not a polygamist. But there's the conflict between the public and the private.
Well, and I'm going to pull Buchanan's Law here. Sorry to everyone listening, but, you know, I have been involved in watching a new schism form in the FLDS. And it's interesting because the new leader, Samuel Bateman, just got arrested for all kinds of, like, heinous charges. But there have been rumors about him doing marriages with minors and all kinds of women for a long, long time. And not that it's directly comparable to what was happening with Nauvoo, because of course, I'm going to say this for anyone that's like, why did she bring up the FLDS? Joseph Smith, to our knowledge, never married a 10-year-old like Sam Bateman did. But the reason why it reminds me of this is we finally have an arrest on record of this man, but for the last 2 years, I've seen men in the council have secret whisperings about Sam Bateman's rituals. There's a rumor floating around that that there are some women designated to be with the elders as spiritual wives only, you know, on these work camps. And it is just a reminder to me that in these secret practices where you're saying one thing publicly, because Sam and the FLDS definitely have a public narrative that they're saying and a narrative that they're saying to their general church, that's really messy, because when you know that there are secret things happening in the leadership, regardless of whether it's FLDS or LDS or Joseph Smith, if there are secret practices that only apply to certain people, it puts people at odds with each other. And, you know, when you're talking about the women in Emma's Relief Society and her shutting this down, it also leaves the Sam Brannans and the William Smith to exploit the vulnerable, the John C. Bennetts, because you don't know who's saying what, because are you going to go and verify everything with Joseph Smith every time it happens? And so you see Joseph Smith barely skirting out of that kind of trouble because some of his elders are abusing it. They are, you know, a little predatory to people who are vulnerable. And yet, how do you verify that? And so Joseph is caught with that on the one hand, but then he's caught in this case with, you know, Emma Smith on the other hand of trying to uphold this other narrative. And to me, that messiness that the polygamy deniers will say it's very clean cut, the fact that it's so murky should be evidence that something secretive was definitely going on.
All right, listeners, you know how this next part goes. We use our obnoxious historian voice and we insist that we have to put everything in context. I know. So, those two Brigham Young statements, you mentioned them at the beginning, there is context. So let's go through where do those statements come out of and what's going on.
Right. So, Joseph and Hiram are killed in Carthage jail, right? And that leads to a lot of chaos in Nauvoo. But at the time of the martyrdom, hundreds of men, including 3/4 of the apostles, were away from Nauvoo on a political mission to help elect Joseph as president of the United States. And Joseph had indicated a number of possibilities for succession without establishing a clear priority of the possibilities, which I believe
if you only guys someone would talk about that at length.
Have been maybe talking about this a little bit recently. So before Young and the other apostles get back to Nauvoo, the anointed quorum became the primary venue for discussing succession. And this is research that D. Michael Quinn talks about a lot in Origins of Power and brings Emma into the conversation in her relationship to power in the succession crisis. So here, so within the anointed quorum, Emma acted not only as Joseph's widow, but as a member of an organization that was unknown to the general membership of the church, that was primarily spiritual in nature, but at times made theocratic or administrative decisions. And so Emma puts forth her preference for William Marks, the Nauvoo stake president and president of the High Council, to assume the leadership of the church. And Marks opposed plural marriage. And so in a series of meetings in July, Emma argues on behalf of Marx, but she was ultimately outvoted and outmaneuvered by members of the anointed quorum who were unwilling to either appoint someone who opposed plural marriage or who wanted to wait until the arrival of the apostles before settling the matter.
And we just talked about that in last episode. Joseph West's whole thesis is the reason why Brigham has such power is he... the reason why Brigham had such power to take over Joseph Smith was polygamy. You see, the polygamy deniers at the time are the ones that don't have those dynastic skin in the game, and they're the ones that really lose out.
Yeah, and this becomes important with women who choose to go marry Brigham and Hiram, so the widows, right? And we'll talk about that in a minute. But so Brigham... And on behalf of the Quorum of the Twelve, so they assume leadership of the church in August. And at that time, there's this break between Brigham and Emma. So they continue to have various interactions, but Emma no longer participates in the meetings of the anointed quorum, did not move west with the saints, and did not participate in ordinances in the Nauvoo temple. So their relationship becomes increasingly tense and they clash over the ownership of Joseph's papers and property rights and other financial issues. But while they both remained in Nauvoo, Young kind of tempers what he says about Emma. In Kingdom of Nauvoo, historian Ben Park suggests that if Young could not directly attack the widow of Mormonism's prophet, he could at least attack her institution, the Relief Society. And so we're a full year out of the end of Relief Society meetings when Brigham makes his statements on March 9th, 1845. And I argue that they are intended to indicate his disapproval of Emma to the men present in the meetings rather than any type of formal disbandment of an ecclesiastical organization. And significantly, he didn't inform the Relief Society of a formal end of their organization.
And when you say it like that, especially after just going over the succession crisis, we're talking a lot about Brigham Young's insecurity when he first takes over. He has to prove to the people that he's, you know, worthy of taking this over. They still have options at this time a year later. Doesn't make a lot of sense to disband an organization that Joseph Smith was apparently publicly such a fanboy of.
Right. And one of the questions I get is, well, did Brigham ever talk to the women? And maybe he just didn't tell them about it because he never talked to women. And that's not really true. So there's at least two times that he interacts with the Relief Society in its first season. So on the second meeting on March 24th, 1842, the women pass a motion that President Joseph Smith be called in to close the meeting. And so Joseph and Brigham and Heber C. Kimball and Will Richards and John Snyder enter the room. And the closing prayer was offered by Brigham Young. And then at the next meeting on March 31st, that's where they bring in the epistle that we talked about earlier. It's also the time when Joseph made his famous statement that the society should move according to the ancient priesthood, said he was going to make of the society a kingdom of priests as in Enoch's day, as in Paul's day. So they read that epistle that was signed by Brigham Young. And so Young, his relationship and his involvement with the Relief Society was limited, but he appeared both in person and in writing to the Relief Society. And then, of course, he didn't attend any meetings as the official leader of the church because they stopped meeting 5 months before he assumed leadership. But he did continue to communicate directly with women about Relief Society adjacent activity on at least two occasions. So there's this time in September of 1844 that he records in his diary that he went up to the stand for a meeting and says, "I then arose and made a few remarks on the sisters' penny subscription." And so that was, the penny subscription was organized by Relief Society members Mary Fielding Smith and Mercy Thompson. It was for women of Nauvoo to help raise funds for the temple. And these were not, it was not an official sponsored activity for the Relief Society, but it may have functioned as an auxiliary to the society in support of its efforts to assist building the temple. There was a discussion early on about can women have auxiliary organizations? And Emma suggested that yes, they can do so. And so after Brigham made his comments, he raised the topic in a financial meeting, and they wrote a letter to Mary and Mercy on December 5th, 1844, asking for the women to send the women the money that they had collected and give it to Bishop Whitney. So, and they did that in two different installments. So he spoke to women from the stand, and he wrote letters to women about activity that they were doing. And he then in the next month, well, in So he was willing to communicate directly with women on matters of importance. And we have some examples of that. He was doing a lot of things, which I'm sure you guys have been covering, ways to kind of assure his power. And he took actions with the 70s. In Doctrine and Covenants 107:26, it states that the 70 form a quorum equal in authority to that of the 12. And so that became a concern to him. And so he goes and vacates the 70's first quorum by ordaining 63 of its members as presidents of 9 local quorums of the 70 that would be under authority of the 12. And Young directs this move openly and went in person to the 70's hall to oversee the action. So when he wants something to change to secure his authority and he wants to change an ecclesiastical organization in the church, he goes in person and sees that it is done, and he communicates directly with the people involved. And so if he intended his words to be a formal disbandment of the Relief Society, he broke from his pattern of overseeing his orders in an open matter that included direct communication with the parties involved. So he also could have shared his decision in the following month in General Conference, in that October 1845 General Conference. He also could have shared his comments the following month in the April General Conference, but he didn't, even though he spoke directly to women about the impropriety of them being baptized on behalf of deceased male ancestors. So he had lots of opportunities to communicate his wishes and did not, which is significant.
He wasn't one known for being vague or, you know, wishy-washy or half-hearted. If he wanted something done, he was very clear and direct and would make it happen.
So I want to talk about the name, because I love your phrasing of a lot of this. You're obviously such a gifted writer, but the shadow succession crisis caused some big waves when you called it that. So can you explain to us what you mean by the name itself?
Yeah. So the succession crisis is sometimes called different things, right? The succession question, succession of church leadership. It's not always crisis, but it's not a singular event. It's rhetorical shorthand to describe those months and years that followed the martyrdoms and the process of determining who would lead the church instead of Joseph. So during the succession crisis, Emma did not call the Relief Society to meet again. And once Young assumed leadership of the majority of saints, like we said, she didn't participate in the anointed quorum or ordinances in the Nauvoo Temple. And so some women maintained a personal relationship with Emma, but Relief Society women who supported Brigham Young had to break from Emma's leadership in order to follow him and participate in ecclesiastical organizations and exercise priestly authority. So viewing this process as a shadow succession crisis provides a lens to excavate women from the records and integrate them into the succession crisis narratives that have previously almost exclusively focused on the words and actions of men, and better understand how the women's use of agency when engaging with institutional power. Aspects of the shadow succession crisis can be seen in records of post-martyrdom plural marriages of Joseph and Hiram's widows, new female initiations into the Anointed Quorum, women's leadership in the Nauvoo Temple, and in the special case of Eliza R. Snow, she published poetry in support of Brigham Young and takes the minute books, the records of the Relief Society, with her across the plains.
I'm going to give a plug here for my favorite thing, which is critical editions of like primary sources, journals, correspondence, things like that. We need to get publishing more of that, just across the board, but particularly women. And this appeared to be fascinating because, as we know, if journals are not published, they don't get used very much because it is hard to go and sit through a microfilm, especially if it's in crappy cursive. And so, you know, having more things, those primary sources readily available will help make it so that stuff gets into our general histories, I think.
And if we were to talk about this shadow succession crisis, like we talk about the it's not simple, but like the male succession crisis, it's Joseph Smith to Brigham. And this idea of Emma to Eliza is really interesting to me because we've always kind of known that, right? Eliza R. Snow, she has a conflict with Emma early on back in, it's in Kirtland, right? Now, where she's kicked on pushed out of the house. Yeah. Is it Nauvoo? What year is it? I should know this, but... So it's in 43. Eliza is kicked out, and whatever the stairs incident is, you know, we know she has a conflict with Emma, but this idea that she takes over, I've always kind of known Eliza is Brigham Young's, you know, Huckleberry, by the way. She really is. She's kind of that. So to look at it like that, it's like a puzzle falling into place, a piece of a puzzle falling into place for me. It's like, it makes so much more sense to have it contextualized this way.
Yeah. And it's not something that, you know, the shadow succession crisis is not as overt as what we call the succession crisis, the men vying for leadership. It's more subtle, and I think it's less strategic. It's something that happens as women use their agency and choose who they're going to follow. And so we kind of see this start to play out with the marriage of the widows of Joseph and Hiram. So, of course, historians debate the number of Joseph's poor wives, but I kind of go with George D. Smith's numbers in Nauvoo Polygamy here. And he identifies Joseph as having 38 wives and Hiram as having 5 at the time of their deaths. So while Joseph only authorized a relatively small number of men within his inner circle to take additional wives after the martyrdom, Young expands that practice. So by early 1846, there are about 200 male polygamists and about 700 plural wives. And several sources have analyzed Young's role in expanding the practice and at times consider his action directly in the context of securing his position as Joseph's successor. But we don't look as much about the women making the choices of who they marry next. So there's approximately 43 widows of Joseph and Hiram. And so 24 of them went on to marry apostles or other high-ranking leaders before leaving Nauvoo. And of those 24, 18, or nearly 70%, had been members of the Relief Society. So this subgroup of Relief Society member widows, some of the women who married Young, Brigham Young, include Eliza R. Snow, who was Relief Society Secretary, Louisa Beeman, Emily Dow Partridge, Zina Diantha Huntington Jacobs, all the last names, and Mary Elizabeth Rowling. So Heber C. Kimball marries Mary Fielding Smith, who was Hiram's legal wife, and Sarah Ann Whitney.
This is just, I mean, as if Mary Fielding didn't have it hard enough. Like, all the women, whenever I hear that they chose Heber, I was like, what's wrong with you? Why?
That's an important subset. We call those the lucky ones. I think that was an oversight that you forgot to say that.
I hate that saying marrying Brigham Young are the lucky ones, but
thanks
you
for
do
being faithful.
Not
you
want
get to marry Heber Kimball.
That's a rough gig.
Another joyful union with Heber was Sarah Ann Whitney, who was the daughter of Emma's counselor, Elizabeth. And then John Smith, Joseph's uncle, married Sarah Cleveland, the other counselor of Emma. So even among plural marriages, these were unique unions that most of them were considered these proxy marriages where the men stood in for Joseph as husbands for time only, while the ceilings to Joseph were re-solemnized for eternity in the Nauvoo Temple. And so the proxy nature of these marriages did not restrict sexual relationships, and they started to have children, but the children of these unions were considered to be Joseph's children in the eternities, which is not odd at all.
Better than being Heber's kids.
So while the women who married Joseph as plural wives in his lifetime were almost exclusively, they almost exclusively did so without Emma's prior knowledge or consent, the widows who entered new plural marriages had since had the opportunity to learn of Emma's strong opposition to the practice. Plural wives who were members of the Relief Society and attended one of the final four meetings in March of 1844 would have heard Emma's strong denouncement of the practice directly. And those who did not attend, or women who were not part of the Relief Society, had the potential to read the Voice of Innocence published in the Nauvoo Neighbor under the direction of the Relief Society. So each of the widows who entered new plural marriages, they had their own reasons for doing so. And in the face of uncertainty, as the saints were preparing to leave Nauvoo and abandon the temple they had sacrificed to build, these women entered dynastic marriages that linked them and their families to priesthood leaders in bonds that they hoped would continue through the eternities. So especially at the start, these women, like, these marriages didn't provide the widows with emotional or material support that were typical of marriages at that time. But for some of the widows, it brought them into the inner circle of Young and the Twelve, granting them access to the anointed quorum and leadership roles in the Nauvoo Temple. And it forged these familial webs that connected them to other saints as they organized wagon companies and went west. So in entering new plural marriages in post-martyrdom Nauvoo, women buttressed the leadership of Young and the Twelve and fundamentally shifted the public relationship that woman-led leadership would look like in Utah. So when women organized themselves into the Indian Relief Societies in the 1850s, and then when Young directed the reorganization of Relief Society and its establishment of every ward in the late 1860s, Relief Society would no longer function as a forum for publicly challenging polygamy. Even for women who did not enter plural marriages, support of Brigham Young and eventually participation in Relief Society required at least tacit acceptance of plural marriage.
One of the things that is interesting about this as you're talking, I'm reminded of these discussions when we talk about these women who are choosing to marry, and we know that they got a choice of who they're going to marry after Joseph dies, these widows, right? The way that I've heard it described are two ways. Either these women are power hungry, scheming, you know, for scraps of power, or they're victims of these men, right? And I'm sure I've been guilty of framing them as both. It's a lot more complicated because if you look at the way that the men were, let's use the word scheming for power, they were organizing and politicking when we know that they were the minute they heard about Joseph's death. It makes sense that the women were doing that too. Women are smart. They act in the same way. They are thinking about their choices, their futures, their behaviors. I just think it's interesting in the way that we frame it as either or. It can't be more complicated than that.
Yeah. Historian Catherine Breckus had this landmark speech about the problem of historical agency. And she talks about how agency exists on a spectrum, how and it can also exist when people make choices to support patriarchal institutions. And so we kind of have to look at these women as still using their agency, even when their choice is to support powerful men. And maybe some of these women had less access to agency as other women, but they are still, you know, making choices and exerting their own agency.
And, you know, I've talked to, it's a painful discussion when we talk about polygamy with women who have been wounded by, or women that have, you know, come from polygamous groups who have seen really the worst aspects of this. Like, it's not, these discussions are not meant to exonerate any sort of doctrinal narrative. But I think it's important to note that this generation of women that we're talking about, their agency is a lot more key than the generations that follow. They're not having daughters that are born into it, whose agencies are complicated by being born and raised into a system. At this point, this is really a spiritual dynasty that they're building. This really is about power on earth and in heaven. It's not about being born into and obedient to a doctrine necessarily.
Yeah, I think that's important to think about. So kind of the next part of this is talking about the anointed quorum, which I know that you guys have done on the podcast as well. Just a little refresher. So Joseph starts it in May of 1842 in the Masonic Lodge of the Red Brick Store in Nauvoo, and he introduces a small group of men to the endowment and washing anointing ordinances. And then in the following year, he starts to introduce women to the ordinances, starting with his wife, Emma, and added marriage sealings as an ordinance among the group. So in September of 1843, Joseph introduces the second anointing, or highest and holy order of the priesthood, which was specifically an ordinance for couples. And in his lifetime, the ordinance only included first wives. So over the following year and until just weeks before Joseph's death, dozens of men and women were initiated into the anointed quorum. At times, the members of the quorum would meet for prayer. So they would like dress in in their temple robes and hold a prayer circle. And while the group was largely unknown to the general body of saints, it was the only priesthood quorum that included both men and women. And so Jonathan Stapley has a really useful taxonomy of types of authority that's helpful here. And there isn't a suggestion that the women in Nauvoo received a specific priesthood ordination through temple ordinances, instead that they acted with priestly authority as ordinance workers and participated in a cosmological priesthood, which modern LDS language and understanding of priesthood really no longer accounts. So, but through the anointed quorum, it was for a short time, like we talked about, was that primary venue for discussing succession, and was the place where Emma attempted to exert her influence. But then Brigham comes in, and the day after he assumes leadership of the church, he assumes leadership of the quorum of the anointed. And at that meeting, quorum members vote to stop admitting new initiates until time would admit. And so while the quorum met a handful of times through the fall and early winter, it wasn't until December of 1844 that they voted to include new members, and not until January of 1845 that new members were initiated. So under Brigham Young's leadership, 24 additional people were added to the quorum. And with Relief Society no longer meeting or fully functioning as an ecclesiastical organization after March of 1844, the anointed quorum became the primary venue for women to hold a role in ecclesiastical body and exercise priestly authority in Nauvoo. So the female membership of the anointed quorum was not exclusively made up of Relief Society women. There's Mary Ann Angel Young, Sylvia Porter Sessions, and Helen Mark Kimball. So they are women who were not members of the Relief Society who were then included in the anointed quorum. But there are many women who had been members of the Relief Society, including Elizabeth Ann Whitney, Eliza R. Snow, Violet Kimball, Sarah Ann Whitney, and other women who accepted Young as leader of the church, and then through the anointed quorum, function in an ecclesiastical body with priestly authority without Emma. So both the male and female members of the anointed quorum were called to meet in the Nauvoo Temple on Sunday, December 7th, 1845, in preparation of opening temple work, and were invited to meet there every Sunday. This group became the primary base of ordinance workers for the next 2 months the temple was in operation, with women working alongside the men night and day in various capacities to move the ordinance work forward.
That's an important point that I think gets overlooked, is because at that point, it's sort of like the anointed quorum plus. It's this bigger group now, but that's the primary venue where Brigham, Heber, George A. Smith, they're sort of talking theological concepts, they're planning for the eventual move. Like, that's kind of the primary locus of instruction, and that's men and women. And that's important to point out, that they're there and part of that.
Right. And so past historians have characterized Brigham's desire for women to stay home until I summon them to my aid as disbandment, but there's no contemporary evidence that Relief Society women heard those orders. But we do know that Brigham called women to his aid in the Nauvoo Temple, and women heard and responded. So under the leadership of Brigham and the Quorum of the Twelve, endowment ordinance work began in the Nauvoo Temple on December 11th, 1845, and continued for nearly 2 months until the wagons rolled west. And from the start, women were leading the washing and anointing ordinance for other women. And Brigham even led a meeting for members of the anointed quorum in the attic of the temple, where he, after a sacrament of bread and wine, he observed that he should henceforth have all cloth which was intended for robes, garments, and aprons brought and either cut or made in this temple under the superintendence of those who know how to do it right. And then 2 days later, so December 16th, Heber C. Kimball's diary records, Sister Whitney and Kimball have been very busy throughout the day overseeing washing and anointings in the female department and instructing the sisters in cutting and making robes and garments. And so the women are overseeing this work and are doing ordinance work, and they're doing this with the express invitation and direction of Brigham Young, and they're participating night and day alongside the men.
When you frame it this way, it almost sounds like Brigham Young didn't diminish their role, he expanded their role.
Right. So the women are doing things that we might consider traditional female roles. So they cut and sew temple garments, they wash temple robes. At times they stayed up all night to do that so that they wouldn't have to pause ordinance work to do the washing. And they sewed cushions and covers for the altars, they cleaned rooms, they even danced and sang at events like weddings, which is really fun. Dancing is for the saints. So historian Christine Wright argues that expanding the definition of temple building to include women's domestic work highlights the importance of female material religion, as well as the economic impact of the work. So women are building the temple doing this work, but then they're also acting in these expansive priestly roles. And from the beginning, you know, these women of the anointed quorum are doing the washing and anointing ordinances. They're acting as clerks. Eliza R. Snow and at least one other woman acted as clerks recording the ordinances. And they are, you know, fulfilling, there's an argument that they are fulfilling Joseph's desire to make them a kingdom of priests. So throughout the 1843 Relief Society season, they would talk about their goal of supporting the temple. They would be reminded of the great blessings which were to be held for them in the house of the Lord. And the temple was very integral to Relief Society. And so Relief Society is not meeting. They stopped meeting in March of 1844. This work is not done in the name of Relief Society. But when the women later reflect on that work, they consider a continuation of the spirit of that work.
And forcing there to be this distinction is the exact kind of thing you would never do with dudes. If there's high priests that are doing X and, you know, no one's taking the time to be like, well, is that an official high priest quorum activity or is this informal? That's never happening.
Exactly. And in the records of the Navajo Temple, there's times that the apostles meet for prayer and there's three men who are not apostles and they're part of the meeting. And it's still the meeting of the apostles meeting for prayer, right? It's not so strict in their records and it all is official. It's not informal activity if men are doing it. So the shadow succession crisis is not as public and overt as the men who were vying for position, but we can see glimpses of this shadow succession crisis in the public writings of Eliza R. Snow. So like Lindsay mentioned, she had previous conflict with Emma, believed to be based around Emma discovering Eliza's secret marriage to Joseph. But Eliza came and visited Emma at the birth of her son, David. So Emma was pregnant at the time of the martyrdom. She has the baby 5 months later and Eliza comes and visits and she publishes a poem in honor of this baby. She publishes another poem in honor of Lucy Mack Smith. And she expresses sympathy for the heartache of the Smith family and all they suffered. But then she also uses her influence in support of Brigham Young. So on February 15th, 1845, 4 months after becoming a plural wife of Brigham's and 1 month after joining the Norte Quorum, she publishes a poem in the Times and Seasons called To President Brigham Young. And she writes, "An important station is truly thine, and the weight of thy calling can none define, being called of the Lord or the 12 to preside, and with them over all the world beside." So with the absence of Relief Society meetings and the lack of opportunity for women to preach publicly, publishing in the newspaper was Eliza's primary means for influence. The public. And when she went west, she took the Relief Society Minute Book with her and carefully preserved it. If she sought Emma's blessing for taking the Minute Book, she doesn't record doing that. Eliza did not speak against Emma publicly at this time, but she moved forward with her own convictions by entering a new plural marriage and using her available means of influencing others and using institutional authority in the temple.
And again, I think there's a good caution for historians to reflect more on how you use language. If Joseph Smith writes an editorial or an article that's in the Times and Seasons, you would never consider that something unofficial or informal because it's not happening in general conference or
we have a record meeting. Every time they wrote a letter and sent someone on a horse to pass a letter across, like every time the men did that. I think with the women, art and material culture is Mormon doctrine and culture for Mormon women. And it's always been that way. And it's always been dismissed because it's so essential to daily living as the men see their spiritual roles as being essential to the spirit. It's very inseparable to me.
Oh Lord, live inside me, lead me on my way. Oh Lord, live inside me, lead me on my way, lead me home, lead me home. Oh Lord, in the darkness, lead me on my way.
And one part of your research is you talk about complicating the historical record. And so we're going to talk about some specific ways on where you're kind of pushing back. And we want to point out here, and this is something that Lindsay and I have talked about in various things. When we're doing things like this, it's not because we're on the side of historian X or historian Y. We're on the side of good, accurate history. So, you know, when you do things like this, it's hard because it can feel personal and, you know, it is hard to have your ideas challenged and sometimes having to admit, you know what, That was not the best conclusion. And so that is a process. But so let's talk about that. Where are we complicating the record?
Right. Because there's a difference between recognizing that Relief Society meetings under the leadership of Emma Smith ended in 1844 and claiming that it was Brigham Young who disbanded the Relief Society in 1845. And that later claim shapes how historians discuss Mormon women's activity in the decades that follow. And the consequences to the record can be startling. So One source where we mentioned earlier that it was significant. So the first 50 years of Relief Society, this is an incredibly important piece of history. You know, there's this incredible collection of historical record of these quality key documents pertaining to the Relief Society and these excellent editorial essays. This is a very important book and it's accessible. It's been made available free online and it's incredibly important to Mormon history and Mormon women's history. But there's this 9-year gap that they have in there. So after including Brigham's March 9th, 1845 statements, it goes 9 years where, with one exception, which was a poem of, well, the Eliza Arsenault's poem, My Father in Heaven, there's no records made by or about women included in that collection. And so this gap is explicitly based on the argument that Young disbanded the Relief Society with his words. And contemporary evidence doesn't support that the women heard his words or that his words had any direct impact on the Relief Society that had stopped meeting a full year before his statements. And so the record picks up in 1854 with minutes of the Great Salt Lake City Relief Society, this short-lived women-initiated organization that met for several months before Brigham explicitly extended his approval for women forming relief societies. And we call this time period the Indian Relief Societies because they were initially helping local tribes. And so this framing centers Brigham's words in rooms of all male meetings over alternative explanations for the end of Relief Society meetings in Nauvoo, including the explanations that women gave in histories of the Relief Society through the later 19th century and much of the 20th century. And so the collection is not limited to documents pertaining to the Relief Society. It includes poetry, historical sketches, speeches, letters, and minutes from related organizations. And so if the narrative were able to recenter on the breakdown of Relief Society as an ecclesiastical organization based on the events of 1844, the framework could open up to include documents pertaining to women's work in the Nauvoo Temple, spiritual meetings in winter quarters, and introduce more nuance and complication through this long transition of the Relief Society from Nauvoo to Utah.
And you said the first documents come in 1854, right?
Yes, correct. So there's this 9-year gap between Brigham's words in 1845 to 1854.
So if you look at that time period, it makes sense that there is a gap in women's records because records become scarce. So if we think of 19th century mind and they're transporting to the Uinta Basin, paper is scarce, first of all. It's not like you can go down to the paper store in Utah Territory and pick up a record book, right? So they're reserving their resources. And women at this time, what we know about their work that they're doing is they are midwives, they are nurses, they are doctors, they are building adobe huts and, you know, building brick all day. So the fact that it's just, you know, that they're not writing it down doesn't mean that they're not, you know, living full, absolute lives with, you know, interior feelings, exterior feelings, expressions. But even the stuff, the documents that we have from that time period with the men are pretty sparse in comparison with like meeting minutes. They're meeting in the Bowery. They don't have, you know, a brick building for a lot of this time. And then when they do, it's early 1850s. That's one of the roughest periods to be a Mormon in general, man or woman.
And I would say, like, too, this 9-year gap is actually pushing that pendulum back from the idea that from like 1844 all the way to 1867, nothing is happening. So it's, yeah, that pendulum kind of is going back and forth. And so it is an improvement, but it's still, you know, that gap needs to be addressed, obviously.
Right. And while records are sparse, for sure, for all of those reasons that Lindsay mentioned, there are records that exist. There are some journals and some diaries and some notes of Eliza R. Snow and other women working as ordnance workers in the endowment house and you know, there are records of, some records of what women were doing, and we could look at how they continued what they viewed as the spirit of that work and how they used authority and how they interacted with power while they kept this vision of eventually having Relief Society again.
And with Eliza, we do know at this time that Eliza is visiting as Brigham Young is sending out these satellite, you know, groups of Mormons all over the territory. Eliza R. Snow and other women in leadership, Brigham Young's wives, are visiting the women and instructing them. And we know about them from their journals, like you said.
Right. Yeah. So Eliza, and, you know, once Relief Society starts up again in the late 1860s, and she goes throughout organizing them in every ward. And there's incredible work being done from the Church Historian's Office right now with the Relief Society, or the Eliza R. Snow papers and with Emmeline Wells papers. And we are starting to get so much more of the women's records from this time, just incredible expansion. But I think there's this time that we can fill in and look at a little bit more closely. So part of the complication of this claim is that there is no contemporary evidence of women hearing what Brigham said in the 1840s. And several sources cite an 1880 record of John Taylor making the claim that Brigham disbanded the Relief Society as support for this claim. But there's problems with using this source, in part because of the bias of John Taylor's perspective, because he was at the meetings where Brigham said these statements. He's in the minutes as being present. And so that may be his perspective. But also, this is only one of several statements he made about the end of Relief Society meetings. And we don't need to go through each statement he made so much as to say that there are other times he talked about Relief Society sleeping for a time or having their actions deferred, or because of the complications of what was happening in Nauvoo, you know, they paused and now their great work is continuing. But there's only this one time that he says Brigham Young was the one who paused this activity, and other times he talks about it in a more nuanced way. And none of these ways that he talks about it are specific detailed histories so much as, you know, it just means that we're maybe putting a little bit too much weight into the one time he implicates Brigham as being part of being the reason, rather, that the women stopped meeting. So
one of the reasons your work has had such an impact is not that it's just new facts or information for us to digest and consider in context with this, but it really is a paradigm changer, what you're saying. So you've talked about how important it is to center women's experiences in your writing and research. Why do you think it's important to center women's experiences in general in the historical record?
So the words of powerful male leaders like Brigham Young matter, but our histories must consider the agency of women and engage in the complexities of both interpersonal human relationships and the institutional follower relationships. I mentioned Catherine Breckus and her argument that we need to remember that agency is on a continuum. And she says, if we view agency as relational and social, we will analyze famous leaders like Brigham Young in the context of their relationships to the ordinary men and women who made their agency possible. So it's not only when women are acting in opposition to male leaders that they exercise agency, they retain agency even if constrained while working within patriarchal structures or when supporting patriarchal leaders. And so there's this widespread acceptance of the claim that Brigham Young disbanded the Relief Society, and it has these ripple effects in Mormon studies for the history of women in the church and the history of Relief Society. And in some books and articles, once that claim is accepted, all of the work of women becomes informal, and we stop looking at it as being in relationship to power and as having the ability to shape the institutions that they took part of, but they absolutely do shape those institutions.
And I love that you say that, because, you know, we're all guilty of that, but even me, you know, who it was so important for me to hear and center the stories of women in your polygamy. When I think about this, I started this podcast episode by saying priesthood never really mattered to me. And yet that's what we focus on because that's what power means in Mormonism. And yet for me, it was kind of irrelevant to my church experience. It was just the order of heaven, which has power and direction in my life, but it didn't really affect how I saw myself or the day to day at sort of a core level. I know that, of course, I can't say that it didn't impact me because it was structural and that kind of thing. But that's the kind of history you're excavating, these actual experiences that we don't even think of. I mean, like I said, Brian and I have had 7 or 8 episodes now where we've hardly mentioned women at all.
Right. And like, to your point, Virginia Kern's book, Sally in Three Worlds, I know you interviewed her. Was that for Year of Polygamy?
Okay.
Yeah. So she doesn't use Brigham's name in her book. She uses the leader in order to like kind of reduce that emphasis on this powerful priesthood leader. He has so much power. And once you bring him in, it kind of distracts from everything
else
going on.
It's not his book. It's her book.
Yes. It's Sally's book, right? It's doing the best to honor Sally's life and story. So I think that's, you know, an excellent example, because here we have, you know, Brigham spoke to men, and even without any evidence of women hearing what he said, Brigham's words shape if and how women are included in the narratives that follow. And so when Brigham's words to an all-male audience are centered over the records and experience of women, the role of women in the restoration tradition becomes contingent upon the shifting emotions of the man with most power. So restoring the actions and words of women to the center of their experience allows for a fuller, more complete, and balanced history.
I love the idea of a pendulum is always very appealing to me when seeing how ideas go. And, you know, we've talked about how it starts from the way Relief Society in Nauvoo transitioning to winter quarters is talked about in one way. Brigham Young, those March statements, not even a part of it. They get introduced, it's a thing, and then that pendulum gets all the way till that's the only thing, and now we're trying to move it back, and it's a process. And this
right.
It's just a lot of fun to watch. So we're so happy you came on. It's been fun watching your research progress. You've presented on it a couple times now. Talk about where this specific research is going in the future.
Yeah. So I hope to publish this soon, and I'll give you an update when one is available to share. But I have, you know, I'm kind of wrapping up this particular paper and this project, and my attention is turning to 2024 and the 50-year anniversary of the founding of Exponent 2. And so I am co-editing a book with Heather Sundahl right now on the history of Exponent and selected works from the newspaper Turn magazine over the years. And that has been just so incredibly fun for me to interview these founding mothers and these editors and these women over the years, and looking at their documents and going to the BYU Special Collections Exponent archives and finding just little pieces of gold in every box.
Isn't it weird doing like this, the Relief Society history, where it's all the figures in them have been dead forever. And then you do a project like this and you're like, I know them. I've talked to them.
Yes. And it is challenging because, you know, writing to change a narrative, there you risk offending historians who are living today who wrote these things, right? And that is a little bit scary to me.
But Brigham can't yell at you. Emma can't yell at you.
No, they can't.
Living people in your book, they're still around.
Yeah, you know, and so far my interactions have just been so incredible. It's been such a fun opportunity for me, and I really look forward to people seeing that book, and we'll send updates when we have publication updates to share, but look for that in 2024 and other things celebrating the 50-year anniversary of Exponent.
And I want to say something about that, because as someone who the Mormon feminist movement has been foundational to me and my development and the work that I've done and sort of just the trajectory of my life. Like, it's been interesting being in the minutia of Mormon feminist organizing, where a lot of conversations are going on, and then it feels lost to the record, right? Even though a lot of ours were online and there's a digital record. But then to know that these discussions that my generation discovered and new generations are discovering were happening always. And the work at the Exponent has been so important to countless women that I know. And so the fact that you're making a hard record of it is so important, because I don't think that's something that the institutional church will do. So having that, which, and we're talking about women that have shifted the discourse in the mainstream church, in fundamentalism everywhere, their impacts. I mean, Laurel Thatcher Ulrich, her quote is quoted like globally now about well-behaved women seldom make history. That's a Mormon feminist that said that. I'm so excited for that. I think it's so important. I feel a lot of gratitude that you're doing that work.
And I have to say that it's actually BYU Library and people there who are scanning every copy of the full run of Exponent and making it available online for free. And they've had had a number of, you know, a big selection of that available for a while, but they are filling in all of the gaps and are just so helpful for us in this project and in making that accessible to people today to see those conversations that have been happening.
So they're not only scanning the old Exponent, but they're scanning the new Exponent. That's fantastic. I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. So the Exponent too. Yeah, from 1974 on. So, you know, most of that is like currently as we speak available on archive.org through BYU Library, and they are filling in the gaps of the rest of it. And I think there will be a 2-year time period that will be just essentially under paywall on the Exponent 2 website. But prior to 2 years of the most recent work will soon be all available online scanned.
Well, thank you so much for coming on, for sharing this work for us. It's exciting to see where this is going to go and to see how the conversation around this idea is going to shift because of your work. And so I feel so happy and glad that you were able to give it to this podcast, because we have been geeking out about this and teasing this for a very, very long time. And so, yeah, is there any way that people can support and follow your work?
You can subscribe to Exponent 2 magazine, and that is probably the best thing to support my current work and my current projects.
Spill my blood upon the earth, oh brother Brigham, brother Young. I beg you, spill my blood, oh brother Young. And let it smoke ascend to heaven, brother Brigham, brother Young. And let my breast be cut asunder, brother Young. As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, brother Young. A blood atoning for my sinning, brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, brother Brigham, brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, brother Young. Let only you can save me, brother Brigham, brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com and consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.